the Financial Sense Lifetime Planning Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Welcome, everyone, to today's Lifetime Planning episode. We are starting to see inflation decline from the highs of last year, but it is remaining on the stickier side. Jim, you recently wrote an article talking about why dividends are one of the best hedges for inflation. We have this at the top of our website, and we'll also include a link to that where this interview is located on Financial Sense for all of you that have not read it yet. But let's start off talking about your view on inflation when it comes to how investors should likely be preparing for the years ahead.
Yeah, the thing that really struck me and caused me to write this article, Chris, is we've been hearing, you know, from politicians, whether it's the president, it's the media, it's always obfuscated by the media and politicians. In other words, inflation is looked at simply rising prices. So anything that raises prices is called inflation. But if you look at inflation from that perspective, what it makes inflation is causeless. In other words, there's no cause behind it. And the Austrians, really, the Austrian economists gave us, really, it has to do with the money supply. Too much money chasing too few goods. And it reminded me, Chris, of a quote by Benjamin Franklin, who said, "The two certainties in life are death and taxes." And to that, I would add a third, which is inflation. And to put that into perspective, if we take a look at why we are seeing inflation, everybody seems to be so surprised. It's been more persistent than many on Wall Street thought it would be, and even the administration and even the Fed itself. Because remember, at first, the Fed thought it was transitory. Then they woke up and said, oh my God, we really have an inflation problem, and began to hike the Fed funds rate at the fastest rate in history. I mean, we went from zero to almost 5% in 1 year. And we haven't seen anything like that since probably 1994. But what I did is I took a look at why are we experiencing inflation today compared to, let's say, over the last four decades. And it's quite simple. I took a look at three things. I took a look at M2, which is the money supply. I took a look at the Fed's balance sheet. And then I took a look at national debt itself. So if we take a look at what has happened since the pandemic, and this goes back to January 2019, M2 money supply increased by 51%. During that same period, the Fed's balance sheet expanded from a little over $4 trillion to its peak, a little over $8.9 trillion, for an increase of 120%. And the national debt grew by $9.5 trillion. Now, let me put that national debt into perspective. It took 250 years of U.S. history and 43 American presidents, from George Washington to George Bush, to accumulate $9.5 trillion in debt. Chris, we just accumulated $9.5 trillion in debt in just 3 years. We will be over $32 trillion by the end of the year, and the Congressional Budget Office is forecasting $46 to $50 trillion by the end of this decade. And if you take a look at that and take a look at where interest rates are now, let's just say they stay at 5 or 6%, you're talking about over 60% of the government tax revenues will go to interest on the debt alone. Because one of the fortunate things, as we amassed more debt, George W. Bush doubled the national debt from 5 to 10 trillion. Obama doubled it from 10 to 20. And Trump and Biden have more than increased that debt by 60% just between two presidents. So we're escalating at a rapid pace the amount of debt that we're adding. And in my opinion, in the end, the Fed is going to be forced to monetize it because it'll just be unmanageable when you compare that to tax revenues.
Yeah, when you look at this chart that you posted, and I'm going to encourage all of you, if you haven't already, to take a look at it in this article. But all three, like you said, money supply, the Federal Reserve balance sheet, and then also national debt spiking in 2020, right around that March time period. And I remember right then, April of 2020, you wrote your article warning all of our listeners, subscribers, and clients that there was likely to be a massive wave of inflation that was going to hit as we are undergoing the MOAB, the mother of all stimulus bombs hitting the U.S. economy. And this 1-2 punch of not just stimulating and expanding the money supply at rates that we've probably never seen before in history, but also at the same time restricting supplies by shutting down everything and basically forcing all consumers into a small handful of approved stores and companies to make their purchases. I mean, you think about it, massive stimulation on the demand side, massive restriction on the supply side. What does that mean? Huge, huge pickup in inflation. That's what we were warning in early 2020. You talked about getting ready for that by preparing, by positioning hard assets. And so now at this point, how does that fit into certain assumptions that are being made by the financial industry currently on how clients should be set up with their portfolios and some of these rules of thumb and where you think that is not going to work in today's environment?
Well, in my 43 years of experience in retirement and financial planning, Chris, I have come to the conclusion that the financial industry has got retirement planning all wrong. And I want to hit upon two major rules that govern our industry. One is the age rule. And what I mean by that is you take 100 minus your age, and that is the amount you should have in stocks or equities. So, for example, you retire at age 65, you subtract 65 from 100, you get 35. And that's the amount that you should have in equities, or 35%. At age 80, if you subtract 80 from 100, that would give you 20. You would have 20% invested in the stock market. The other rule that we use is called the 4% rule. And that is you withdraw 4% of your portfolio every single year. So, for example, let's just make the math easy. You have $1 million portfolio. So if you take out 4%, that would be $40,000 a year. And you could do that for 25 years and voila, you know, you've covered yourself in retirement. The problem with both of these rules are inflation and bear markets. And I want to begin with inflation. So if you take a look at, and what really struck me is Barron's recently did two articles about retirees living longer. One was called High Healthcare Costs Are a Challenge Even for Healthy Seniors. And that article basically said, look, if you are healthy, you take care of yourself, well, you're probably going to live longer. But one of the consequences of living longer is you're going to end up spending more money on healthcare. The other one was Rethinking Retirement Savings in Light of Longer Lifespans, basically saying you're going to be living longer, you're going to need more money to take care of you through retirement. And the other issue there is in inflation. Right now for seniors, healthcare inflation has been running between 6 and 8% a year. And we've often talked about, we break your retirement into three phases. Phase one, 65 to 75 are the go-go years. You're really healthy. You're doing the things you didn't have time to do when you were working. The go slow years, which are 75 to 85, and then the no-go years, 85 and beyond. And if you look at the way retirees spend money, it's the go-go years, phase one of their retirement. They're spending a lot of money. They've got hobbies. They're joining a golf course. They're traveling. They're in their RVs. And you're spending a lot of money doing the things you didn't have time to do when you were working. Phase two, you're a little older now. You're slowing it down, maybe not as many trips. So maybe you're cutting back on some of the spending. And then phase three, the no-go years after 85, that's really when you're getting hit with these healthcare costs. You might have to be in assisted living, a long-term care facility. You have more drugs or procedures that you're going through because of age. So you're going to need more money. And so what I did is I took a living expense of annual living expense of $75,000 a year. And then what I did is I showed various inflation rates of 3, 4, 5, and 6%. So in 10 years, if you were spending $75,000 today, 10 years from now, you're going to need over $100,000 with 3% inflation, 134,000 was 6% inflation. Fast forward 20 years out, you'll need 135,000 with 3% inflation and 182,000 in 30 years. So in other words, when you get into those no-go years, you'll need almost more than twice what you started out with your retirement. It gets even worse when you start looking at a 4% inflation rate. You would need $250,000 a year to live 30 years from now and $164,000 20 years from now. So what I wanted to show is as you age, as you live longer, inflation is going to require that you get more income. And the implication of that is this age rule that says you should have less in equities, Chris, makes absolutely no sense to me because let me give you an example. And what I did is I'm going to show you two examples. Let's suppose you put $100,000 in a bond 10 years ago. 10 years ago, the best you would have got on a 10-year treasury note was 2%. So 10 years ago, you were receiving 2% interest. It was a 10-year bond. When the bond matured 10 years today, you're still getting the 2%. However, the purchasing power of that $100,000 bond that you bought 10 years ago does not have the same purchasing power today. Under a 3% inflation rate, that 10-year bond has a purchasing power of $73,000. Under a 4% inflation rate, it's $66,000. It gets even worse if you go out longer term. So let's say instead of a 10-year bond, you have a 20-year bond. You know, we've seen people with 20-year munis, 20-year treasuries, 20-year corporate bonds. With the 3% inflation rate, 20 years from now, that $100,000 bond would have a purchasing power of only $54,000.
Now, you do talk about bonds in your article, and you make a pretty strong recommendation against bonds, and you even cite Warren Buffett in this as well. So can you tell us the 60-40 bond portfolio, where does this fit into your overall argument here?
I'm against it. I don't think it works. Now, let me put this out. We do own short-term bonds. We own short-term treasuries, and we own short-term corporates that are under 2 years or less, because I don't want to own a 10-year bond with the kind of inflation that we have right now. Had you owned long-term bonds last year, long-term bonds lost over 20%. It was probably one of the worst years for the 60-40 portfolio. The S&P was down 20%. Bonds were down 20 to 25%. The NASDAQ was down 30. So I don't like when we're heading into a period of inflation, and I think we're going to be dealing with higher inflation. I don't think the Fed's going to win this battle. And the reason is fiscal policy is so enormous now. It's one of the reasons that's keeping this economy afloat. I mean, you got to understand the Biden administration authorized $7.5 trillion of new spending on top of the other spending that we're doing. Then on top of that, we're funding a war in the Ukraine that we've spent over $100 billion. So, I mean, these guys in Washington are spending money like drunken sailors. And what that is doing is putting more demand, shoveling more money into the economy where the supply and production is not keeping pace. So that's why last Friday, the markets reacted. The Fed's consumption expenditure index came up. It actually went up last month versus going down. And that's why I think inflation is going to be a persistent problem. So I don't want to be in something that's going to be losing its purchasing power 5, 10, 20 years from now. By the same token, when I'm going to need a lot more income 10, 20, and 30 years from now. So that's why I think a bond is a poor investment. I'm in the Warren Buffett camp. I think it's a terrible investment. I mean, how are you going to pay for increased living? If you spend $75,000 a year now, and you're going to need over $100,000 10 years from now to keep pace with inflation, or $135,000 20 years from now, how are you going to get that income? It's not going to come from Social Security increases, because that index they use to index your Social Security payments is a special index that's massaged by the government to keep those increases to a minimum. So you have to have something to increase so that you can maintain your standard of living, both in principle, in terms of purchasing power, but more importantly, in terms of income, that are going to allow you to live the same lifestyle on day one in retirement versus 10, 20, 25 years from now.
And as we've discussed many times in the past, you know, Warren Buffett, with his goal of investing in companies that have very large moats, putting an emphasis on large cap blue chip dividend paying stocks that increase their dividends, that's the same philosophy that we use here at our company. And Warren Buffett's mentor, Benjamin Graham, is someone that you've also read his books and you consider a mentor as well. So, you know, Warren Buffett is obviously one of the most successful investors, but we take that same philosophy in terms of how we invest here at Financial Sense Wealth Management. And for all of you that, you know, if you haven't read the article, we do quote and link out to a number of different statements that Warren Buffett has made on bonds. But I do want to just cite this one quote. "It is a terrible mistake for investors with long-term horizons, among them pension funds, college endowments, and savings-minded individuals, to measure their investment risk by their portfolio's ratio of bonds to stocks. Often, high-grade bonds in an investment portfolio increase its risk." And he goes on to develop this thought much more in depth. But the point here is that there are situations where adding long-term bonds, that is 10-year bonds, 30-year bonds, long-duration bonds to a person's portfolio, may not be the best option. And so, again, Warren Buffett, we at our company are putting more emphasis on blue-chip dividend-paying stocks. But more importantly, those stocks that are continually raising their dividends and have the free cash flow to do so.
Yeah, that was one of the reasons I wanted to write this article. And then we're going to get to dividends in a minute. But I want to cover one other rule that also doesn't work, and that's the 4% rule. As I mentioned earlier, had you had $1 million, you take out 4% a year, that's $40,000. It would last you 25 years. So what I did, Chris, is I took $1 million portfolio, and I began January 1st of 2022, and I assumed it was all invested in the S&P 500 index fund ETF, which is SPY. So if you were taking out 4% a year, that would be $40,000, or roughly $3,333 a month. So January 1st, you would liquidate enough shares to get you that $3,033, which in January, it would have been roughly about 7 shares. And then what I do is I show what happened to the price of the S&P in the value of the shares over a 12-month period last year. Now, remember, last year, the S&P lost over 20%. So by the end of the year, you have taken out $40,000 by liquidating shares every single month. By the end of the year, the SPY went from $477.71. It closed the year at $382.43. So had you been liquidating each month according to the 4% rule, which is what majority of investors do and what is used in this industry, at the end of the year, your portfolio was down to $763,000. You lost $337,000. Now, let's begin January of 2023. Instead of working with $1 million, you now have about $250,000 less, and you're not going to be taking out $3,333. Last year, the inflation rate was 6.5%. So in order to keep up with inflation, you would need to increase your distribution or rate to $3,550, which is a 6.5% increase. And so that's the problem you're going to face as a retiree. Every single year, you're going to see your cost of living go up. Medical premiums, gasoline, food prices, utility bills. I mean, the utility rates are so high in California, they've skyrocketed from natural gas to utilities because of Newsom's banana green policies. We're shutting down our nuclear plants. We're shutting down our coal plants. We're shutting out our natural gas plants. And it's driving the cost of utilities up. So as a retiree, every year your expenses go up. And that's why this 4% rule doesn't work, because number one, you have to increase your distribution each year to account for inflation. And number two is when you're drawing down your investments during a bear market, you're liquidating shares at a lower price. So that's why last year, had you done this, you lost $250,000, or you were down $250,000. And bear in mind that bear markets can last 2 to 2.5 years. I mean, the bear market of 2000 to 2002 with the bursting of the tech bubble, that lasted 2.5 years for a loss of 50%. The financial crisis lasted almost 2 years from 2007 to 2009, and the markets lost 55%. So we're in the second year of a bear market, as I expect stocks to do poorly this year, given what we're seeing, what the Fed is doing, the inflation numbers, and where I think we're heading. The LAIs tell us that we're going to be going into a recession the latter part of this year, which means lower profits. Lower profits means lower stock prices. So imagine you started out with $1 million last year. You're starting out this year with $750,000. And what if the markets go down 10 or 15% this year and you're liquidating? Chris, you could be down to $500,000 by the end of this bear market. And so that we call that in the industry sequence risk, where the beginning of your retirement, you're hit with a bear market, which can be very devastating to your portfolio. So I think, Chris, the two common rules that we use in retirement planning, the age rule doesn't work because of inflation, and the 4% rule doesn't work in bear markets. The 4% rule only works in periods like the last decade, where stocks went up every single year for 10 years. It doesn't work. Think of the 00 decade. The first 2 years of the 00 decade, the market lost 55%. We spent another 5 years with the market recouping back to where it was in January of 2000. But then we went through the great financial crisis and the markets lost over 55%. So it would take from January of 2000 to April of 2013 to break even on prices with the S&P. So basically, the stock market went nowhere for 13 years. Imagine if you were drawing down your savings during those two devastating bear markets, where in 2000, the markets lost 50%, in 2007 to 9, they lost 56%. So it does, those two rules, Chris, don't work given those circumstances. And we're more likely to see inflation going forward. And where I'm sure this bear market, which could carry into next year, will not be the last bear market we experience this decade.
So again, just to reiterate, since 2020, we've seen a dramatic increase in the national debt, the Fed's balance sheet, the money supply, and as a result, a large spike in inflation. Politicians are largely blaming everything but their own policies. And unfortunately, we don't think that these pro-inflationary policies are going to be quickly reversed, as you just pointed out. In that case, why do you think that dividends are a better way to go versus fixed income?
Well, in the example I gave previously of what happened to the purchasing power of a 10-year bond, the income never changes. It's fixed. And that's what bonds are. They're fixed income investments. So if you get a bond that pays 2% is what you would have gotten 10 years ago, it's still paying 2% 10 years later. So what I did is I took a drug stock, an oil stock, a couple of consumer staple stocks, and I took a look at the dividend yield today and where it would have been on your original capital. Assume that you bought these dividend stocks 10 years ago in place of a bond. And, you know, like a drug stock, like AbbVie, the yield on original capital, if you take a look at where AbbVie's dividend is today after 10 years of dividend increases, and the dividend growth in this stock has been over 9% a year. So your dividend yield today on your original capital is 12.9%. If you look at companies like Altria, the dividend yield is 17.6. If you look at oil stocks like Chevron, the dividend yield is 8%. If you look at Coca-Cola, it's almost 5%. Procter & Gamble, it's almost 5%. So your income, in many of these cases, doubled during the last decade. So that was keeping you even with inflation. The other thing is what happened to the value of your principal. If, in contrast to a bond, if you own a $100,000 bond, when it comes due, you get your $100,000 back. But as I pointed out, it doesn't have the same purchasing power 10 years later. Well, I took a look at these stocks. What would have happened had you just held on to these stocks? And they were up 3, 4, and 5-fold over the last 10 years. So not only did your income double, in many cases more than double, but also your principal doubled, tripled, or quadrupled during that period of time. So you had more purchasing power of principal, and you had more income to spend. I want to contrast, Chris, ETFs and mutual funds versus owning individual stocks, because investors believe that when the markets go down, their income is going to go down if they're invested in equities. And that may be the case if you're in an ETF or a mutual fund, because as stocks go down or markets go down, those portfolio managers see their customers liquidate their shares, forcing the portfolio managers to sell off stock to meet redemptions. Now, contrast, so you may see your income go down along with the price of the ETF or the mutual fund. In contrast, if you own individual stocks, you're not subject to the psychological whims of fear and greed of investors. So I took those same stocks, and what I wanted to do is I went back to the financial crisis of 2007 and 2009, and I took 5 or 6 stocks. I took Johnson & Johnson, Procter & Gamble, Chevron, Coke, Kimberly-Clark, Walgreens Boots, and I took what happened to the dividends each year. Each one of these companies raised their dividends in 2007, they raised their dividends in 2008, and they raised their dividends in 2009. So in the midst of probably one of the worst financial crises that we had since the Great Depression, these companies raised their dividends each and every year, in many cases substantially. For example, Johnson & Johnson in that 3-year period during the financial crisis raised their dividends 32%. Procter & Gamble raised their dividends 43%. Coca-Cola raised their dividends 32%. Walgreens raised their dividends 78%. So, Chris, had you done nothing and just held on to your shares, you would have been getting 8 to 10% dividend increases every single year during the financial crisis. And guess what happened? When the market took off in March of 2009, all these stocks were back to their former highs. Coca-Cola, which had dropped from 30 down to 19 during the financial crisis, by the end of 2009, it was right back up to $30 a share, having raised its dividends 32% during the financial crisis. That's why Warren Buffett has often said, you know, they could close the financial markets and I could care less, because he emphasizes on his investments buying companies that have huge cash flows that throw off that cash. He either buys the company outright or he buys the stock like a Coca-Cola that generates large amounts of cash flow. And it really struck me, and it reminded me, and I remember this early on in my career, in 1988 and 89, Warren Buffett bought 23 million shares of Coca-Cola. And then once again, in 1993 to 94, Buffett increased and quadrupled his position in Coca-Cola. He took it up to 100 million shares for a total investment of $1.3 billion. What do you think that investment is worth today, Chris?
You know, I would imagine it's probably in the billions.
That $1.3 billion investment is worth $24 billion today for a return of 2,000%. Buffett now owns 400 million shares of Coca-Cola thanks to stock splits, and he owns 9.25% of all the outstanding shares of Coca-Cola. And by the way, a lot of these companies, whether it's Coke, Procter & Gamble, Johnson & Johnson, these companies have been raising their dividends 50 and 60, or in the case of Coca-Cola, 70 years in a row. And that's why, Chris, I think they are the perfect inflation hedge for somebody that is retired. A lot of these companies today offer dividend yields that are very competitive with treasuries, everything from 4% to over 7%. And not only that, more importantly, they're going up every single year. And what I like about individual stocks, Chris, I don't know where the S&P is going to be at the end of the year. And even the technicians we have in our show, when they talk about the future, it's an estimated guess. So I don't have a lot of confidence in my ability to predict where the S&P is going to be December 31st. What I have a 90% confidence level in is I know with 90% confidence where my Coca-Cola or Procter & Gamble dividend or Johnson & Johnson is going to be at the end of the year. It'll be higher than when we started the year. I also have a higher confidence level where it'll be next year. So that's why I like dividend-paying blue chips, especially Aristocrats that have a history of increasing dividends 25 years in a row. That gives me that confidence to be able to plan knowing where my income is going to be at the end of the year and where it's going to be next year. And that is a certainty I don't think you can invest or get investing in mutual funds or ETFs. And it's why I like dividend-paying stocks in a retirement portfolio. They provide predictability. They provide certainty. Now, of course, there is no guarantee that a company will always continue to do this. And that's why we monitor them in their financial balance sheet, their cash flow, and their business. But these are companies that have predictable business models. They provide a product that people need or a service that people need. And they do well, whether the economy is doing well or we're in a recession or we're in a booming economy. And that's why I think they fit more into retirement. And you don't have to deal with the 4% drawdown rule and sell off shares because you're getting enough income. One of the things that we tried to achieve in my income portfolio is a 4% yield. So we are aiming to get 4% or more to achieve that 4%. The difference is, Chris, it's coming from income rather than coming from principal, which is a big mistake in the drawdown rule.
You know, Jim, we have our technician segment that we have every weekend where we speak with various technicians from all over the world. And part of that is they, a lot of times, will talk about what their view is on the market on a very short-term time frame, could be on the order of months or even for the remainder of the year. But a lot of this has to do with market timing, as technicians are a bit more short-term focused. One of the guests that we regularly have on Financial Sense News Hour is your good friend, Ralph Ancampora, who's considered the godfather of technical analysis, and many people know his name, and he's pretty famous in the industry. But you had an interesting conversation with him in the past when it comes to balancing the ups and downs of the market, and particularly market timing, and then how that relates to how you invest in your own portfolio. Let's listen to what he had to say on this point.
I got to tell you something very personal. My lovely wife, Rosemary, was a financial advisor, and her whole thing was retirement. I mean, Rosemary retired several years ago due to illness. If not, she'd still be doing it because she loved it. And her clients called and called me and said, oh my God, we're going to miss Rosemary. She's been so great to us. What she did is she tied everybody up, including us, in these high yielding situations. And I remember in 2007, 2008, when that market started rolling over, I went down to Rosemary. I said, honey, I think we got to start selling this stuff. She said, please, we're in there for the long term. You told me that same story, Ralph, in 2000. And we went down with the market and went up with the market. If you're in those high yielding stocks, as you said, Coca-Cola or telephone, I don't know. We have more. And we just ride them out. And, you know, it kills me as a technician. You know, I see these breakdowns and tops and, you know, I'm looking, running for the hills. And her argument is, you know, you got to time it correctly getting out, and then you got to time it correctly getting in, and then you're paying taxes on your profits. And, you know, from a long-term investment point of view, people in their 60s and 70s, I'm 77 years old, and No, we don't mess with anything. Oh, we have a few dollars. We'll play around with crazy stuff. But by and large, the majority of our money is exactly what you described. And I'm saying this to everyone. This is personally what we've done. And thank God Rosemary was adamant about it and didn't listen to me turning the account. So I'm, you know, lucky enough to be able to buy the family farm. And if not, I think I'd be a cow on the farm.
So, you know, Chris, that was interesting. Here's probably one of the top technicians, the father of technical analysis. He had a wife who was an investment advisor on Wall Street, and she pursued the blue chip dividend portfolio with her clients. And here she was, you know, basically, even though Ralph's a technician, their own personal portfolio was invested in these dividend paying blue chips, and they just sat on them because, as his wife Rosemary said, is, look, Ralph, if you sell them, first of all, you got to sell at the top, and then you have to pick the bottom to get back in. And then on top of that, you're going to have to pay taxes. And right now, you know, the top tax rate on capital gains is 23.8%. You add high taxes like New York that can run double digits, same here in California where it's 13.3%, you can pay almost 37% in federal taxes and capital gains. That's a bear market in itself. And like he said, we just held on to them. They came right back. And that's a point I was trying to make in this article, that they're one of the best inflation hedges that I know of because they're predictable, they're consistent, and they're reliable. And that is something you don't have with a mutual fund or an ETF, which is why I just love them for retirement.
Now, Jim, before we close, I think there's two points that we should address. The first is just to make clear that we do have multiple portfolios that we manage here at Financial Sense Wealth Management. Some of them are more actively invested, where we raise cash and we'll move into short-term bonds, or we will manage money according to the business cycle. We have a core set of funds that we typically do not touch, but there is more of an active management for our growth style portfolios. And then on the other hand, we have much more conservative portfolios, which are appropriate for certain people depending on their age and suitability. What we're referring to today is mostly in reference to the income account that we have here, which is a much more conservative, less actively managed portfolio with an emphasis, like you said, on short-term bonds versus long-term bonds, and then also deriving a large amount of income from these dividend-paying stocks. So that's the first point that I just want to make clear. The second point, Jim, which you brought up earlier that I think we should address, is for what happens when you do have a stock that you hold in the portfolio that cuts their dividend. Because like you say, sometimes this happens. We invest in companies that have a very good track record of increasing their dividends. And we try to make sure that we invest in those that have the free cash flow and the income in order to maintain or increase their dividends. But there are occasions, like we've seen in the news even recently, where a company will suspend a dividend. What would you say in those instances?
Well, I have two rules, Chris, when it comes to choosing dividend achievers. I look for a combination of dividend yield plus dividend increase. So say, for example, I buy a stock that has a 4% dividend. In order to meet my dividend rule, it must increase its dividend 6% a year. So the combination of the dividend yield plus the dividend increase equals 10%. And I'm happy to say that we've actually done better than that. We've been getting 4% in yield, and we've been getting 10% a year in dividend increases. In fact, last year was our best year ever. We had 11.6% increase in dividend yield. So when a company fails to meet that, and I got rid of a technology company. Well, in fact, we got rid of most of our technology stocks in 2021. But the last technology stock I was holding, I got rid of because the dividend increases are now only 2-3%. So it failed to meet my 10% rule. So there's a couple of reasons I would get rid of a stock. Number one, if you were looking at the company and watching their free cash flow and it looked like it was deteriorating. Number two, the dividend payout was extremely high. Now, in some industries like utilities, you can make an exception to that, but utilities have a higher payout. But typically, I like to keep the dividend payout below 50%. That gives ample amount of money for the management to invest in the business and grow it. And it also easily covers the dividend. So we watch the balance sheet. We look for excess of debt. We look for increasing cash flow every year because it's that cash flow that's going to pay those dividends. So if cash flow starts to decline, if the dividend payout starts to go up, if their debt starts to increase, it gets yanked out of the portfolio and sold. So, you know, there's definite rules. It's not just set and forget. You have to monitor this. But I would say, Chris, overall, it's a lot more predictable. But those would be the reasons I would sell a stock.
So to sum things up, Jim, number one, inflation is likely to be persistent. This is something we've been discussing again since 2020. And we believe that that will likely be the case for the remainder of this decade. This is something we've talked about many times, looking at demographic factors and many structural factors that lead to this view. In that case, number two, the age rule doesn't make sense when you're looking at a longer term inflationary backdrop, especially if you're just moving into long-term bonds for fixed income. You want to be, again, looking at blue chip dividend paying stocks to hedge against a longer term inflationary backdrop. And number three, given that we are in a bear market, and we think that this is one that is going to continue, if not necessarily correcting down, but in a more longer-term stagflationary-like environment, which we saw in the 1966 to 1982 time period, as we've also discussed on the show many times. In that situation, the 4% drawdown rule is also not a good rule of thumb to follow. So given those three points, I would like to close just by saying that Financial Sense Wealth Management has been in business for over 35 years. We've invested through the ups and downs of many business cycles. We have a variety of different portfolios and accounts that we manage. And as well, Financial Times has ranked us as one of the top financial advisors in the United States. So if you'd like to get in touch with us to know how we can assist you either with financial planning or asset management, you can do so by going to our website, financialsense.com, and clicking where it says contact us. Or you can also give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Well, that concludes today's podcast. We hope you enjoyed it and found it informational. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Planning. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant week.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.